Right.
And the only thing I'm making sure, I like to start over, but I don't want them to go right after me with the tax, you know, liabilities that that I went and refinanced the house and took that money out already.
Right.
To spend it and use it on whatever I had to.
Right. Yeah. And now for just for our education here, there is just talking about the tax liability. There's all kinds of little complexities with tax liability for what the IRS code calls cancellation of debt income. One of the basic fact is that if you borrow money and then the lender cancels your debt or forgives part of the debt, then you do have a taxable income at that point of the amount of the debt that was forgiven. There's all kinds of exceptions to that. The biggest exception is was signed into law December 20th, 2007. And if it was your principal residence in some general cases, you don't owe cancellation of debt income. So even if you get a 1099 from the IRS, in many cases, you don't have to pay any tax on it if it was your principal residence. However,
it's not my principal residence.
It's not your principal residence. And the other issue is if you take money out and you don't put it in your house, then that money is also accepted from this cancellation mortgage relief act that they passed. So just for people's information. Now, if it's not your principal residence at all, there's also a couple of other tests. First of all, if you are forgiven on a non-recourse loan, you don't owe income tax on that cancellation of debt income if it's a non-recourse loan. So in California, you could, you know, your tax advisor and you could discuss this, and you might arrive at the decision that since California is a non-recourse state on a first mortgage, that's a non-recourse loan. And therefore, on the first mortgage, you don't owe anything on that cancellation of debt income. And you know, I think a lot of people have taken that position and been aggressive about it. So that's something for you to talk to your tax advisor about. Now, the second mortgage is a different issue, you know, because the second mortgage really is a recourse loan. They probably don't have any equity. Is that correct on the second?
Right.
So they could go after you personally, and you know, they can do it as an unsecured creditor after the foreclosure has completed. And let's say that you just let it go. The first mortgage will file a notice of default, then a notice of trustee sale. 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, it'll go to a sale. The lender will probably get the property back because there will be no higher bidder. And that first mortgage holder will then own the property. Now the second mortgage holder is in a position of having a note that you signed, and they're unsecured, and so now they could go to court, and they could get they probably would prevail on a simple breach of contract complaint, and then they could get a judgment against you. So that's a concern that I would have beyond the tax liability. If the second mortgage holder wanted to reinstate the first, make the payments for you, they could then foreclose on the property. And then they would, you know, presumably get the property back subject to the first mortgage. And then they would have done all they could do, and that would be it. However, that they're not going to do that. Chances are there's no equity for them to foreclose on. They're not going to want to make the payments on the first and foreclose on you. They're just going to have to let it go. So when this is all done, they're going to still have the fact that you signed a note, and they have the ability to pursue a civil action in court for a collection, basically a collection action at that point. Mm-hmm. So that's true of almost anybody these days with a second mortgage, even in a state like California where, you know, you can let a first mortgage go without really any personal liability. The second mortgage is very different. So that would be my concern and why I probably wouldn't just walk away from the property. I'd probably try to do a short sale instead. You know, I don't think that let's say that a lender has a portfolio of second mortgages. If they don't collect on that themselves, somebody will offer them, it could be pennies on the dollar, and they will buy out the loans, and they'll start going after people. You know, they'll buy the debt and they'll start pursuing people on it. It just isn't going to happen that you have a big debt like this and nobody bothers collecting on it or trying to collect on it. It's just not going to happen. I think they're going to try to collect on it. That means you can do a settlement with them. You can do all kinds of things. It's certainly not over at that point. But I don't think that they would just let it go. I don't see that happening. I see them coming after people all the time.
So your advice is to do a short sale, and then if that doesn't work, just basically walk away from it.
Well, I mean, I think a short sale was the best way to go because it gives you you're negotiating with the second now, and so you can negotiate the terms of a note or how much you owe them or how you're going to pay it back and partial payments and all of that. Plus, you'll get more money for the property if you market it than they will if they get it back. Because if they get it back, they're going to have all kinds of financial losses and foreclosure costs and lawyer's fees, holding costs. They're going to, you know, end up doing, you know, lenders are very poor in not all cases, but most cases of disposing of properties. So they're going to end up, you know, saying you owe them all this extra money. Whereas if you do a short sale, you'll stop that process and fix the amount that you owe. It's not going to keep going up at that point. And I'm talking really about the second mortgage, not the first, because the first can't do anything to you.
Right. So even, would it help even though if both the loans are in the same lender, or does it matter?
Well, it doesn't really matter. It makes it a little easier, but not much, not really. Because, you know, remember, the lenders are just servicing the loans for someone else. In some cases, if it's a bank, let's just say it's Wells Fargo. I'm just picking that out of a hat because they've done a lot of loans in California. If it was Wells Fargo, they might own the HELOC or the second mortgage, but the first mortgage has long been sold off to somebody, so they're servicing that, so they don't really have any real control over those two loans.
Okay, you pretty much answered my question there, so that's more like me deciding how to do it, basically to do a short sale there.
Yeah, it stops the thing, and it gets the costs and everything stopped and fixed and gives you a negotiating position. You know, if worse came to worse, you know, you could always consider a bankruptcy filing if you had to. So that serves as a bargaining chip to help give you some power in the negotiations with the second. Yeah, it's not a lot of fun, but I do think it beats just letting it go and letting the cost keep running up.
Final bankruptcy if it goes to foreclosure, and if they go after the bankruptcy almost might be the last choice.
Well, yeah, because you if they go after you, it's as an unsecured creditor like a credit card would, and so bankruptcy is is an effective countermeasure against an unsecured creditor. So that can, you know, kind of put the fear of God in them a little bit and give you a better negotiating position than you would otherwise have.
Oh, okay.
And what I suggest in this situation is you might want to do is consult a bankruptcy lawyer. I have found paying a bankruptcy lawyer like $200 for an hour consult is very helpful in these times in my life when I've had great difficulties, because especially a good one, like, you know, on the course we have a fantastic guy, Jason Jones, who says these things on this that I don't think a lawyer would tell you if you were his client, but maybe Jason would. But I find a good, straightforward bankruptcy lawyer who likes to talk people out of bankruptcy, spend an hour with him or her, and, you know, you'll feel a lot better about your situation and know what your options are. I think that's a good idea.
Okay, I agree with what you're saying.
Good. Thanks so much. Good luck to you.
Hey, thank you.
Hi, Richard.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Yeah, it's really interesting times. I'm in Everett, and I'll just go ahead and use my name. I don't really care for anonymity. I'm an open book. My name's David. I've got a condo in downtown Everett that I'm short selling, and the first lender is City, second lender is WAMU. And essentially, after listening to the interview you had last week, Richard, with that lawyer, that attorney, it gave me some ideas on to look through my loan documents that I'd received, because I filed my loan documents, just keep everything filed, and to go through them and see if there were any Truth Lending Act violations. And being a mortgage broker, I have an idea of obviously what we have to comply with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through there, and essentially I found about six to eight counts of simply gross negligence in the fact that every single form that needed to be notarized, such as the deed of trust, was not. Nothing was notarized. The verification of the closing agent being there for third party objectivity, that wasn't even signed. The Truth in Lending disclosure itself was a legal size page, and the next page was a letter size page. So the following page was superimposed over the TIL disclosure, which means essentially I didn't get the TIL disclosure, which is frankly the E on the I chart, and the notice of right to cancel, the big one. The notice of right to cancel did not have the dates of when it started, neither did it have the dates of when it ended. Therefore, that in itself means that the recourse, per the lawyer you spoke with a week ago, is essentially, you know, they credit all the interest back to the borrower and have a 0% loan for the life of the loan. I don't want to do that with my mortgage. I want to short sell it. So I simply used that as an addendum, not in a threatening manner. I was respectful, and I simply, you know, I entitled it TILA concerns. I just made it look like, hey, these are concerns that I have, whereas I know that they know and they know that I know that these are some serious federal statutes that have essentially been, in my view, broken. I called my attorney friend up, and he said, yeah, that's pretty much correct. He said, don't be a pain about it when you present it with the short sale package, but let them know you know, and they'll clearly realize that it would probably be in their best interest to, you know, report it as paid-settled, which you advise in your book on the credit report.
Wow, what a story.
Oh, yeah.
So you looked at the documentation, and because you're a mortgage broker, you could see very clearly and easily that there were these certain obvious glaring issues. Like, just for the benefit of the folks listening, for example, the notice of right to cancel is like a fundamental part of Truth in Lending Act, and that has to have a date on it, and it has to give you, what is it, 5 days for rescission, or what is it?
Three business days, counting Saturdays, not counting Sundays and or holidays.
And so that date is extremely important, because without that rescission and that date and all of that, they're totally out of compliance.
Exactly.
And then you were able to also see that these other parts of the package were not notarized, and that's also in the act. And what there was the one about the truth in lending disclosure. What was wrong with that?
Every bank calls it something different. This was a home equity line of credit, so it wasn't necessarily called truth in lending disclosure. It was called basically an itemization of finance charges. Truth in lending is what they called it. They called it the disbursement instructions and installment loan amount financed itemization truth in lending disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So, big mouthful. Mm-hmm. Well, that being a legal page, have you ever tried to copy a legal page and a letter page, and sometimes it prints out one copy,
mm-hmm.
and the letter page has been superimposed onto the preceding legal page?
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, that legal page, you only have maybe about 20% copied, which is at the very top.
Right.
The rest is the next document. Well, that's what happened. Two pages, two forms became one. So essentially, I never got the form.
Now, you had this original package of paperwork, because Deborah emphasized, she said, I won't even take a case unless a prospective client has the original documents, the papers that they were given at the closing. And you had those papers.
Yeah, what they do is whenever you sign, whether you go to the lender themselves or whether you go to the bank themselves or the escrow company, closing settlement company, they'll give you copies. You know, you'll sign it, and then they'll go make copies. Because these guys, though, however, presented me with copies at the signing before I signed it, and there was no notary there.
Wow.
And so, and frankly, honestly, I believe the reason why is because, well, what'd WAMU just do? Kerry Killinger's gone, put options are up. They were lending in the heyday. Nothing against WAMU, they're a great bank, but man, so much, just no one, it's oversight.
Right.
Lots of it too, apparently. Lots of oversight.
So it was just sloppiness and people eager to close another deal.
Right, exactly.
What would the commissions be on a deal like that? I mean, I know, you know, you may not know what they were on your deal, but what would they typically run for that kind of deal for the person that originated that?
Well, to be honest with you, home equity line of credit have some of the lowest commissions because it's a portfolioed loan. They keep it. They make the money off of the interest payments because it's based on prime. Now, they'll typically charge you a point, and then they'll make around $1,500 on the back end. So it's not one of those exorbitant option arms mm-hmm. with three-year prepays that a lot of people got stuck into. Just stupid loans. It's not one of those mm-hmm. loans, but it's not one of those.
It was simple floppiness. But since you picked up on that, now you have leverage against them. And what you've done, let me just see if I have the strategy right. What you've done is you're mentioning it to them, the negotiator on this. You're not saying I'm going to sue you and I've got my lawyer on it. You're just saying, hey, you know, I know, and you know that there are these issues.
Right.
In a low-key way. And why do you do it that way as opposed to blustering about it and, you know, getting your lawyer and sicking them on it? Why did you choose that route?
Well, probably because blustering about it hasn't worked for me, and that's my natural tendency. So being 26, you learn to shut up and listen, I guess.
Well, I could see the benefit of it is that they will go to their legal people and they'll review this and they'll say quietly to themselves, maybe we should just, you know, give this guy some concessions and move on with it. We don't want to attract a lot of attention with this issue. And that's an advantage of mentioning it, but not making the, you know, the blustery big lawyer sic-em deal about it. Maybe that's the reason that that's a good strategy.
Yeah, I just won, frankly. Condo value went down 20%. And, you know, I just want to get out from under it. And it, and the value is clear. I mean, I got your book 2 weeks ago and I read it and everything. And I looked at all the resources. And you have some good points on how to write up that hardship letter without to get them to not go after you, the non-recourse, and how to have it reported, and especially how to do the BPO appropriately. That, I think, frankly, is the meat and potatoes. This simply is just a handy little addendum that I think is additional leverage.
Yeah, well, some people really, you know, if we've heard some of them, and there's a lot of others, they could really use the leverage. It's, you know, sometimes it could be vital for people. You know, it's been in a very tough situation. Did you submit the package already to the first lender also?
I did. I already actually talked to City, the loss mitigation people in City, and they're kind. They said pretty much the mainly the investor for them is typically Freddie Mac, and Freddie Mac requires that the second lien holder makes no more than $1,000 to $3,000 on a short sale. And I've done things. I'm helping people modify their own loans right now for free. Just I haven't figured out why I'm doing it for free yet, but honestly, I'm just trying to get the experience, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so about four or five people, and so I'm starting to ask them, hey, what about, I'm starting to ask them to bring in their notice of right to cancel because I'd like to take a look at it. But not being a lawyer, obviously, I can only say, hey, this is what I'm doing. But City said, yeah, the second mortgage companies are settling. They said B of A is definitely settling on that $1,000 to $3,000. HSBC, I know of for a fact, just one settled, was a $54,000 second mortgage. They settled for $1,000.
Now, remember that doesn't mean that they're releasing you from liability or releasing the borrowers in this case.
Right. That's, yeah, but, you know, I mean, I'm not scared of Chapter 7. I mean, it makes sense sometimes.
Right.
I mean, I know people that have declared Chapter 7, you know, as long as you're under the state median income for Washington, $70,200.
Right.
As long as you're under that for your net income, then after a year to 2 years, your credit will be back up to, I've seen upper 600s. I mean, no
credit, absolutely.
Clearly, but.
Absolutely. I mean, your credit isn't, it may suffer, it'll suffer for a couple of years and, you know, but it absolutely isn't the end of the world. And that's a good point. One thing that, you know, I talked to Jason Jones about this a few weeks ago, and actually I think I posted about this on the Free and Clear Club. There is this median income means test. So if you make less than the 50%, the median income of 50% of people in your state, just again for the benefit of our listeners, you can then file a Chapter 7 discharge, which is really what you want. So in theory, if you make a higher income than that, you would have to go Chapter 13. And Chapter 13 is a huge drag. It's a lot. It's expensive. It's years of having your finances overseen by a trustee. It's really a disaster for everybody. However, as Jason pointed out, the lawyers can help you be very creative, and you should, if you're in a position where a lawyer is saying, oh, you know, you need to be Chapter 13, you should question that. Jason said that there's also an alternative means test where you deduct your car payment, whatever it is, and your house payment, whatever it is, and then you use what's left over, and there's a chart that you can get that's part of this means test that's online. And if you meet that alternative means test, you can go Chapter 7, even if your income is over the mean, the 50% mean for your state. So it's essentially like it's not exactly after expenses income, but it's partially after expenses income. So that's the second means test. And he also pointed out that, in addition, there's also, it's only a six-month look-back period. It's a six-month period. So if you needed to file bankruptcy, what you can do if your income is too high, you know, you might lay low for a while. You might just delay the filing. And as long as that last 6 months, you know, you meet one of those two means tests, you know, you could do that Chapter 7. So as it turns out, people can be pretty creative and be fully within the law and do a Chapter 7, even though it might seem like they'd have to do a 13.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a really incredible story. That's a really great story. So I think that's Very helpful. I'm so glad that you shared that with us, and that, you know, I think a lot of people are really going to be, feel that's been very helpful.
Yeah, you, real quick, you'd mentioned, lenders are cooperating, put it that way. They have to cooperate. Look at the stocks. I mean, options are screaming through the roof on these, on banks, on all financial stocks, just because they're cooperating, and they won't say that. You know, I emailed you once about that short refinance, and people don't even know it exists yet, but it does kind of, but not yet.
Right.
And I think you're going to see more of that within 6 months to 12 months, but that'd be nice to have a conference call on that stuff, maybe.
Yeah, I've encountered it so little from all the hundreds of people that I've talked to or corresponded with, and I have encountered it, and they have a person, they've had them sign an NDA, non-disclosure agreement or something, but I have run into it, but not that much. And you know, you say lenders are cooperating. I think a lot of people would not agree with that assertion, because the short sales are taking so long, and the buyers are losing patience and moving on, and meanwhile the property is declining in value further. And you know, I don't see that same mode of cooperation. I don't say it's completely their fault. I think that there's a systemic problem, because the note holders are somewhere else, and there's just a whole communication issue. But there's also an issue of not having enough negotiators. Maybe they're not paid enough to service the loans to have enough of a staff, but we just see them being so slow, and they a lot of times do things that are not in their best interest. So I don't know.
Interesting.
Maybe it varies with where you are, too. Okay, so I'm going to – I think we'll continue for another 14 minutes here, and
Yeah, hi, Richard. It's King Kong.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Very good. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you.
Very interesting presentation. Thank you very much for all the information.
Oh, pleasure.
I've got a couple of questions. I have two properties. You know, I'm in California. I have two properties. They're primarily in the same community. I just received a notice they want me to cure. I haven't paid the note in a couple of months on both properties. They're both about 50% upside down, and large negatives as far as the payments are concerned. I have a renter in one property, and the other property is vacant. I'm wondering if there's any what effect a renter has in the income that comes from that property. Does that have any effect on short sales or negotiations with the lenders?
So you've got two properties now. Is one of those your principal residence?
No.
Okay, so there are two rental properties, and you would like to get out from under both of these properties?
Yes, that's correct.
Are you making the payments on them? Are they current?
They are not current. I've stopped paying. I think this is going to be my third month this month.
Okay, on both of them. So yeah. On one of them you have it's vacant, and the other has a renter that's current with you as far as paying rent?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And have you actually talked to the lender about anything yet? Because I'm sure that you said that they contacted you. What was the last upshot of the last conversations you had with them?
I talked to one property has, they both have two loans on them. One property has first and second with the same lender, which is a Fremont, and the other property has a first with Aurora and a second with EMC. I talked with EMC and about my situation. They're willing to reduce my payment $100 or something along those lines. And I explained to them that, you know, I wasn't sure if I would be able to take advantage of their offer, because I had to speak with the first mortgage before mm-hmm. I could agree with anything with the second.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And so anyway, they sent out some paperwork, wanting is a financial statement and agreement to make the payments at the reduced rate, which, you know, I haven't responded to them yet. I'm still, you know, I just got all your information. I paid for the program, and I bought the information from you. I got that information. I've been going over that information before I do anything with anybody.
Now, were they saying that they'll permanently reduce your payments, or is this going to be a temporary situation?
It seemed to be a temporary situation.
Right. Right. So that's a forbearance, and that's a pretty typical response from a lender, as opposed to a loan modification, where they'll actually have a addendum signed, a legal contract that's changes the loan forever. So that's a you know, lenders will like to do a forbearance because it keeps the loan performing on their books, and you know, that's not a difficult thing to get. It if you meet the income requirements, it may not be in your best interest. So anyway, so continue. So what else? What did you do as far as the first?
I have not talked with the first yet. As a matter of fact, I got several letters from the first. On the first, I've got you know, letters a week apart. One letter is just kind of a courtesy letter. Hey, you haven't paid. The second letter is, hey, call us. We can work out some things. We can do loan suspensions. We can do loan modifications, and we can do a couple other things. One other thing.
Well, you know, if it were me, and again, I'm not a lawyer, and my disclaimer is blah, 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 blah. If this was me, I would do a short sale, and I would get out from both of these, because the property values are continuing to decline. Negative cash flow, you know, you can spend your life worrying about these awful debts. I don't know how old you are, but we should all be saving money and trying to build our lives financially more conservatively than we have in the past, because we're entering some tough times. And I think that I would do a short sale. Now, if you have a tenant in a unit, in a property, it's very hard to sell that property. So you really want to get the tenant out. I would get the tenant out, and I would, which is sometimes easier said than done, I would get the tenant out, and I would sell the property, and I would try to do either find a realtor who can do a quick sale for you, or do the 9-day sale yourself. But I would try to get those both properties sold. If they're close to each other, are they very close to each other?
Yes, they are.
Are they in like the same, you know, development?
Yes, they are. They're about a block apart.
Yeah, you know, the 9-day sale, there's ways to do a 9-day sale where you can sell both properties on the same weekend, because the people will come, you publicize them very heavily, and there's an inspection period, and people will go to see both properties. And I've talked to people who have sold several properties in a weekend this way, so it's actually a very nice way of doing it.
What about offering the property to the current renters?
Oh, it's wonderful if you can do that. But the trouble is that a lot of times the renters are paying so much less in rent than what their payment will be if they were to buy that property that they won't qualify financially.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if my tenants may have that problem. I think they're in business. I think they may be doing well as far as income is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, for example, I know somebody who's paying $2,500 a month rent. If they buy that property that they're paying $2,500, their payment will be about $4,500 a month, principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. So they have to qualify for a $4,500 a month a payment. And, you know, the typical traditional parameters are reasserting themselves, housing being no more than 28% of the gross income. And so, you know, and so they really have to have a pretty high income. And that's the trouble with it, because we're still at a point where the rents are much, much less expensive than the cost to own that same property. I predict that when this thing is bottomed out, it'll be when the cost of buying a property will cash flow out with the rent, and we're not there yet in a lot of places. You see what I mean?
Yeah. On the other property, on the Fremont property, I have two loans from Fremont on this property, and I got the last letter I got from them dated May 12th. I got two letters. One is a notice of intent to foreclose, and the other is a notice of assignment or transfer of the servicing rights.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering what's going on with that situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the notice of intent to foreclose is a collection notice. It's designed to scare you to get you to pay. That's all it is. Legally, it has no significance. The first, you're in what state?
California.
Yeah, the first initiation of an actual foreclosure proceeding in California is a notice of default, or NOD, that has to be filed with the county recorder's office where the property is located. And that's and usually mailed to you and sometimes posted. And that's the first official notice that initiates the foreclosure process. A 90-day clock starts ticking at that point, although it could go much, much longer. So that notice of intent is nothing. It's a collection notice. The other thing you got, though, is telling you that someone else is going to be servicing the loan. It's could be for two reasons. The most probable reason is that this portfolio of troubled loans is transferred to somebody who's more of a workout servicing company. So, you know, that's not, you know, that's pretty common these days. So it just means you'll be dealing with somebody else.
Okay. Is a notice, I'm sorry, a short sale versus a deed in lieu of.
Okay.
So can you explain the differences of which one would be the best option?
That's a great question. A deed in lieu of foreclosure can only really be done in two situations, where you have one loan and not two, or when you have both loans, two loans, but they're serviced by the same lender. So that otherwise a deed in lieu can't be done. And so if you have loans with two different lenders, you can't really do a deed in lieu. It's very impractical. What a deed in lieu is simply you have an agreement, you sign with a lender, and then you sign a grant deed or a warranty deed, depending on the state, it's the same thing. And it transfers the property back to the lender. And in return, you know, they may agree to to release you from liability, or they may not, but meanwhile, you know, the thing is over. Now they own the property. The advantage to them is they didn't have to incur all the costs of the lawyers and the foreclosure costs and all of that. The advantage to you is that you're out of it, you know, more or less. They still may come after you later if you don't get a release, but you're essentially, the foreclosure part of it is gone. It's over. It's behind you. However, deed in lieu is not that common in states like California because it's pretty easy to foreclose on a property in California, not that expensive. And deed in lieu, they have to, you know, they have to market the property and sell it. And, of course, they would if they got it back through the trustee sale. But it's not that common. I haven't seen it. I see it a lot more in states where they have a very onerous or difficult foreclosure process. And there they do a lot more deed in lieu.
Okay.
And in addition, with two loans, the only time I've seen it with two loans is where people have the same lender. And again, in states like certain states that have judicial foreclosure. It's certainly worth trying because it's a lot easier for you if they'll do it. Because, you know, but I don't think, you know, I don't think they will.
You don't think they will? Okay.
Especially with two loans from two different lenders.
Okay. Well, one of them is one lender with two loans.
Yeah, in that case, it's I've seen it done. I've seen it done where people with Countrywide, where someone had a first and a second, both serviced by Countrywide, and a number of times. But again, I've seen it mostly in other states, not California. Not to say it's not worth trying, because it is. It's worth trying.
Okay. Does a derogatory on your credit, late pays, and all the other things, those stay on your credit 7 years? Is that correct?
They stay on your credit 7 years. A bankruptcy stays in your credit 10 years. A judgment stays in your credit 10 years and it can be renewed in some states, in California, for example, another 10 years. But delays and things stay on your credit 7 years. Now, they stay on your credit report, but a lot of, you know, the credit that we're getting these days is done by computer algorithms, and Fair Isaacs, the FICO score, is the most common credit score that credit grantors rely on. And the FICO score, although it looks at delinquencies to come up with a score, it's the last year or two especially are important. So once you get past a couple of years, a year and a half, 2 years, and you've been on time, you know, your credit can be, you know, pretty decent because it's the recency that really matters. And the lates are only a third of it. There's also how much of your existing credit lines you're into, and some other things. So you know, you could have these delinquencies and everything, and still have, you know, pretty decent credit in a couple of years. And that's without even doing things which you might be able to do in the interim, such as settling with the lenders, where they might even be able to remove some of those derogatories. Who knows?
Okay. Unpaid real estate taxes. Do they follow the home, or they stay with the homeowner?
No, they just follow the home, so they're not personal to you at all. The lender will end up paying them. Someone will, you know, the lender, if they get the property back, they'll have to pay those.
Okay.
And so it'll be additional money that you owe them, in theory.
Okay, I understand. Okay. That's all the questions I have.
Well, good. Good luck to you. Thanks so much for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your service. Well, I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Let's see. We're going to do one more call, and then we'll call it a night here. 586, how are you doing? Can you hear me okay?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hey.
I had you muted.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Richard. It's Bessie. I'm good. The last fellow's last question about the real estate taxes following the property. So if we do a short sale and we, well, so let's say we do an auction and it is or isn't a short sale, in either case, I put this in that email to you, can we put it in the paperwork of the short sale or the auction, winner gets to pay the taxes?
Well, the you don't need to. You don't need to do that. I mean, it might be a good idea to disclose it, but it's not really necessary. There's a purchase price that's determined at an auction or a 9-day sale or whatever. Let's just call it $300,000 just for our example here, Betsy. There may be various liens on the property and those all have to get paid off against a $300,000 purchase price. So one of the liens might be a first mortgage of $280,000. Another lien every property has property taxes, and sometimes they're not paid, and that's another lien. So the title company or the escrow or the settlement lawyer, depending on the state, they'll simply take the purchase price and they'll do a title search showing all the liens on the property, and then they'll do the arithmetic and they'll disperse the funds that the buyer brings in to pay off those liens, including the back taxes. So you don't have to do anything about that. You don't have to even say anything about it because it's going to happen anyway. That's part of the settlement process.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a big one.
It is. I mean, what are yours just property taxes? Or are they also homeowners assessments?
Yeah. No, just property taxes.
Okay. Yeah, some people also have these homeowners assessments, and they get really nasty. Somebody in Florida that I know has a $60,000 per property assessment, $60,000, you know, and the homeowners association incurred this huge debt, and they assessed everybody, and that causes enormous problems. But you know, at the very worst, you know, it's another lien on the property, and certainly it doesn't go with someone personally; it applies to the property.
Okay. That was so simple.
Well,
so in other words, back to the 9-day auction.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to clear it first with the mortgage company. We can just go ahead and do it, put the short sale package, it may not be a short sale.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. If you do a 9-day sale or any sale, it may not be a short sale. You really don't know necessarily. Now, there are rules and ethical obligations for realtors, and there are rules for disclosure that vary from state to state. And it certainly is very important, especially in certain states such as California, that you disclose everything that you can about a property. And so if you were going to do a 9-day sale, in the data sheet, you would want to put down that it might be a short sale because you don't know. You don't know how much you're going to get. And so it probably would be a very good idea to put that in there, in the documentation that a prospective bidder gets. But since you don't know if it's going to be a short sale, I don't see how you'd have to put that in the ad because you don't really know that it is going to be a short sale. If you did know it was going to be a short sale, you'd probably be obligated, you know, you might be obligated to put it in the ad that it's a short sale because, you know, I think it's a very material thing to advertise that buyers should know. But if it's not a short sale, it's awfully nice. So you could actually take, let's say that it's borderline. I assume it's sort of borderline, right, Betsy?
Well, yeah. I mean, at the rate, at what we owe on it, it's easily worth that in value. I mean, obviously, Michigan, yeah, we're struggling with price values, but still, it's a lot of house for the money. So even if we just got what we owed, that wouldn't be a short sale, and somebody would be very happy. So.
Well, if you do a 9-day sale, you could advertise it as not a short sale and just not do a short sale, and you'd probably have a higher turnout and more interest because a lot of buyers have been burned by short sales, by these endless delays and by the lenders dragging their feet, and they actually will look for something that's not a short sale. Now, if you know, you'd have to be honest about it. You know, you would be doing the 9-day sale. You know, hopefully get some money in your pocket.
Yeah, I mean, you could put in there, in the event that this turns out to be a short
sale. That's
right. You know.
That's right. You'd want to put that.
Then what? We're just warning them about...
Then it's subject to lender approval.
Factors.
Yeah, then it's subject to lender approval. Disclosures you give to somebody who bids. But if you know it's going to be a short sale, you know, you probably have to put in your advertising. But if it's not, you're not sure.
How can you know? You can't possibly know.
You can't know, exactly. Well, some people would know that for sure they're going to do a short sale, but you're not in that position.
Yeah, they're going to know if they're in way deep.
Yes, yes.
Then, yeah, they know that they can't get that much money. But we're right in there, so really, you know, we just don't want to pay a realtor. You know, I know that there's not that in there, you know.
Right.
They're just sitting. You know, I think the potential here of getting the activity going through, you know, advertising the way you say.
Yeah, well, and we're going to have a lot more information as we get more and more people doing 90-day sales, and we have a lot of realtors coming on board. There's a lot of, you know, good ways of publicizing and marketing the property prior to the inspection period that we're going to be sharing, which I think are very, very helpful.